A generation has come of age which thinks of the shopping mall as the town center. William White doesn't much like shopping malls. He prefers the vitality and spontaneity of city streets, and he spent the last 20 years studying how people interact on city streets. White's study dates back to 1969, when the New York City Planning Commission asked him to help write a new city plan. His subsequent research has included countless hours walking the streets of New York, watching how people use them, and studying films of city life shot by his hidden cameras perched high above the city streets. His findings are published in his new book, City: Rediscovering the Center. Over the past 20 years, White has served as an urban planning consultant for many major U.S. cities, where he's challenged the conventional wisdom about how to revive urban centers. You might also know White as the author of the now classic 1956 book, The Organization Man. It was about the dilemmas faced by those who worked in the corporate world, people who surrendered their individualism for financial security. I asked William White why it's so important to him to make sure that we keep urban centers alive.
Well, they're the center of the metropolitan area, and they're very important for suburbs. I grew up in a suburb, small town. It was about 25 miles west of where you are now. East, I should say. West, yes. Westchester, Pennsylvania. And the fact of Philadelphia was tremendously important for all of us who lived in that small town and all the other small towns. It's where you derive your sense of where you're at, and all of the great metropolitan areas have a wonderful sense of directionality. So I don't see this as a case of the small town or the suburb versus the city. They need each other.
Mm-hmm. I think that you've observed that a lot of planners have designed or redesigned cities based on false assumptions. So you've been trying to find out how people actually use the city so that planners can plan according to reality. Is that right?
That's right. One of the things that's happened in about the past 20 or 30 years is that we now have a new generation of planners and architects and whatnot, most of whom have never known what it's like to be, what it's like to see, for that matter, a good, old-fashioned, thriving downtown. I have very vivid memories of Philadelphia, for example. And to me, that was part of the thing that was fun in life.
You started doing your current research during a period when planners thought it was very important to relieve the high-density population in urban areas, to relieve some of the pedestrian traffic. And what you found in your study was people actually really like crowds, or at least they gravitate to crowds.
That's right. To me, the most fascinating piece of research we ever did, thought it would be a very fine idea to find out when a couple of people meet on the street, old friends and whatnot, and of course, naturally, they're going to get out of the way of the pedestrian traffic stream. And my thought was that they would move right to the lee of the building. And I set up time-lapse cameras and recorded what they did over a long period of time. To my surprise, I found that they were moving not away from, but into the pedestrian traffic stream. And the longer the conversation, the more apt it was to be smack in the middle. So people talk one way, but there is this tremendous impulse to centrality.
Mm-hmm. So people actually hold their conversations right in the middle of a crowd.
Yes. Well, watch the next time you're in a reception or a cocktail party or something like that. Watch how, as the evening progresses in the afternoon, how they tend to cluster more and more in the smaller spaces, with other spaces left absolutely empty.
Now, a lot of people in cities think of the street vendors as a nuisance because they take up so much of the street, you have to walk around them. And a lot of the merchants are opposed to vendors because the vendors sometimes undersell the merchants. You found that vendors actually play a pretty important role in cities.
I think you've got to make distinctions.
Okay.
But you've got some pretty rascally vendors. There's no question about that. But even the ones who sort of wink at you and sort of let on that this is stolen goods, it's not stolen goods usually. They're special houses that specialize in that merchandise. I have a very mixed emotions about the dealers. I think it's terribly important when you're talking about street characters, street people, to make distinctions between them. And this is what a lot of business people, and retailers in particular, don't do. So they will see, let's say, a harmless street performer, and they will classify him almost as though he were a dope peddler. There's a tremendous difference between these people. And you take certain kind of vendors, I think, perform a rather real function. Food vendors, for example. Here in my city of New York, they're caterers of the outdoor life of the city. And every time that they get shooed away from plazas and whatnot, it's interesting how the life of the plaza diminishes. They're I think, basically a very important influence.
What kind of vendors do you think are a problem in the city?
Well, dope, of course. Since I started my research, two things have happened. One, I think the dope thing has gotten much worse. And there was dope around, 16 years ago, certainly. Now, of course, they're omnipresent, and it's a terrible scourge. Then, of course, the other thing, which is different, but nonetheless equally a scourge, and that is the homeless. And I must say that I am floored by the question, what do we do about the homeless? And it has had a terrible influence, not only on the homeless themselves, and it seems to me certainly on our conscience, but also for any kind of program. Every time I talk to people about, let's animate this particular spot or this park or whatnot with events, you always come up against this problem of, what about the homeless? And we don't have a solution for that.
Well, sure, a lot of people designing public spaces, small parks, little plazas, are afraid that if they make it comfortable, if they're seating, that it will just become a home for the homeless.
And it's that belief. It's that belief is the problem, because it doesn't happen to be true. I beg your pardon. That if you make a place very, very attractive, you're going to attract a lot of homeless. Curiously, in a perverse sort of way, I'm not talking about so much about the homeless now, as I am about street characters and street people. In a perverse sort of way, they stay away from places that are well-liked and well-used by most people. And so to me, it's tremendously encouraging for all these problems that you go to a wonderful small park such as Paley Park, Greenacre Park, these lovely little things, and you think they'd be run over with homeless, or they'd be run over with all sorts of dope deals, and they're not. They're not. They're a place where you see great displays of civility. So I think it is true that if you make a place that's comfortable for people, that doesn't solve the homeless problem. It doesn't solve it. But it's an awful lot better than what so many people do in so many cities. And then I said, let's make it uncomfortable for the bad people. And they stick spikes in the ledges, and they make ledges too high to sit on, and all that kind of thing. It's ridiculous. It's very immoral, for one thing.
So you've even found a lot of plazas and public spaces where seating has been removed to discourage homeless people from staying there.
Yes, but by the same, let me cite sort of the opposite sort of thing. I think of the Philip Morris people. They sort of like the city, people that run the Seagram building the same way. They're not in the slightest exercise over the fact that maybe some morning they look out there and there's a bum, sleeping off a hangover or something like that. Their feeling is, okay, as the day wears on, the bum won't be there anymore. And what the question they ask is, well, the sun rises, life goes on. They don't worry about it. They're very urban.
If we follow with your finding that the best solution for a public place is to make the place attractive for everyone, what kind of public space seems to be attractive to everyone? What recommendations do you have to designers of public spaces?
Well, the first thing I do is tell a designer, spend some time at the busiest street corner in town. The greatest open space in a city is a wonderful street corner. Because the most important ingredient of a successful place is a great mixture of people. And this is one of the great things. One of the first things I noticed when I sort of stood out on the streets or started taking films was the, to me, surprising number of chance encounters, old friends running into each other. And I saw this happening day after day with a frequency which really floored me. And I began to realize that this was not accidental, that this really was a actuarial probability. When you get a good, tight downtown, and all the great downtowns are tight, that is, most of them have a good, tight grid pattern, the chances are that you're going to run into a lot of people that you know. That's one of the great attributes of a center city. It's much more social, than people realize. Now, you ask about what other kind of spaces. I think the small urban park, this is a personal bias on my part, the small urban park is an utter delight. By that, it could be, I think of Paley Park in New York, which is all of 42 by 100 feet. Now, that's a very small space. And curiously enough, it attracts, on a nice day, you'll get about 180 to 200 people sitting, mind you. Now, that is a very strong, that's a very high density. And Paley Park and Greenacre Park in New York are the two places that are most often cited for being, very comfortable, very relaxing, not overcrowded, quiet, and so forth. And in actual fact, they're rather noisy. They're usually crowded, as a matter of fact, of places that you go to voluntarily. They are the two most crowded places in New York. But they have a number of sort of standard ingredients which seem to me rather surefire. There's a water wall, makes a wonderful sound, sort of masks the street sounds. Most important, they are removable chairs all over the place. Not one has ever been stolen, by the way. They have a wonderful canopy of honey locust to foliage overhead. Very deceptively simple in a way. Oh, incidentally, always a nice little food counter. And they're a wonderful place to stop or to meet somebody and say, well, why don't we have a cup of coffee at the park?
Mm-hmm.
It's a lovely place, lovely place.
If you're just joining us, my guest is William White, and he's a consultant to city planners. He was the author of the 1956 book, The Organization Man, and his new book is called City, Rediscovering the Center, and it's based on about 20 years of research he's done on how people use the city streets. Now, you point out that in a lot of successful public spaces, there's a mayor, you know, either the vendor or a newsstand operator who's there in the same spot every day. Everybody checks in with him when they get there. The mayor knows a lot of people by name. Does that serve a certain security function?
Yes, it does. It's security. I think more important than the security in the sense of bad people and stuff like that, more important is a sense of belonging, which we all enjoy. It's a sense, this is my city. So the one that guy says, hey, Doc, put on a little weight there, aren't you? I mean, you're being recognized by a regular. And it's a rather comforting thing. And I've noticed in talking a lot with people who, when we talk about what they, how they use the city, what things they like, what things they don't like, this is one of the great attractions, going somewhere where they're known. It may be the familiar stranger. You don't know the name of the news dealer or whatnot, but the guy is, oh, good evening, how are you? Boy, it's cold and so forth. It's a wonderful little moment of the day.
Mm-hmm. You've told us some of the successful designs of public spaces. What do you think are some of the worst mistakes designers of small parks and plazas have made?
The worst mistake they can make is to shut it off from the street. Now, the most usual way of shutting it off from the street is a great big wall. We've seen quite a few of those. Or they may sink it, you know, down 10, 12 feet to get them away from the bad people. But the wall is the worst of all. And almost invariably, these places are dog places. Nobody uses them very much. Bryant Park in New York is a beautiful park with these lovely, lovely old trees and whatnot. But it was built on the idea that let's protect people from the street. So lining the street facade of the park are, one thing is elevated, about 4 feet above the street, are fences and shrubbery and so forth. And the thing has always been a flop. People haven't used it very much. And there's now a very heroic and, I think, extremely intelligent effort to redo the park. And the main thing that is being done, quite aside from the band concerts they're going to have and the restaurants and all these wonderful things, is they're bringing it back to the street. They're cutting down all sort of the things that make it difficult to wander in there on impulse. And all the great spaces, you sort of move from the street into the space without quite realizing that you've made any transition.
You make a plea in your book for more public restrooms. And I think anyone who lives in a city or works in a city would share your interest in having more public restrooms. But then the problem is, once there are public restrooms, you're afraid to go into them because you're afraid you'll encounter muggers or dope dealers once you get inside.
It's a very real fear and very in many cases, very justified fear. I would qualify and say that we really ought to come back and have more restrooms. I think that they have to be attended to really work rather well. And that calls really for sort of a municipal restroom. I was very struck in the discussions about making City Hall in Philadelphia a much more, you know, lively place for people and have it sort of a gathering place for the citizens. And one of the finest things they could do, there are plenty of room in the restrooms in City Hall, sort of large and dark, is making a point of having really good attended restrooms and also restrooms with that wonderful and very, very important thought in mind, restrooms for mothers with children in tow.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you something else about the way the homeless population has changed. There's so many people living on the streets now. And I was wondering if in your observations of how people use the streets, if you've observed how they deal with homeless people, whether most people try to ignore them, pretend that they're not there, walk around somebody who's sleeping on the street, or whether they're stared at, they're spoken to, they're given money to, or have you observed these things?
Yes, I have. Very tragic thing. I think they're pretty much taken for granted. They're part of the furniture now. They weren't, you know, about 4 or 5 years ago. You do have to step over. And a lot of them are, we've greatly swelled the ranks of beggars. When I started my research, the beggars that I studied, that I saw, were by and large professional beggars. That was their livelihood, and you saw them every day in the same places. The kind of begging that we see now, but the greatest in numbers, are the homeless with their poor, pathetic cups. And I think that we feel terribly uncomfortable. We're reminded of things we felt we shouldn't be reminded. It's a hell of a problem. It's a hell of a problem. And well, the fact that we sort of take them for granted is one of the worst parts of it.
Begging has gotten a lot more aggressive
lately,
and a lot of people who ask for money on the street have this implied threat, you know, that if you don't give it to them, that, you know, they could hurt you if they wanted to.
Yes.
There's frequently that implication now. And I wonder how you think this is affecting the way people use streets, because I think a lot of people have become more concerned about their safety on the streets.
Well, theoretically, they should. You would expect to see a diminution of street activity. I keep fairly good records of the number of people out on the street, which incidentally is a very overlooked tool. If you want to find out what places people like and what people don't like, just count the number that are using a certain place. I have not noticed any diminution, really, in street life. And I think that I'm speaking sort of as one who lives in New York, and we seem to have the best and worst of everything at times. And I think this is just sort of part of the scene. And I'd say with a good bit of callousness, unfortunately. But I don't think it has had a very drastic effect on street life. I'll tell you the really drastic effect on street life is in the smaller cities, which have lost their nerve. They've lost, they've lost their sense of importance, their sense of uniqueness and whatnot. And so they try to fend off things like the homeless by erecting suburban shopping centers downtown where they don't belong. In other words, fortresses. And they say, look, well, let's attract the middle class back from suburbia. And the only way we can do that, really, is to offer them security from the city. In other words, to entice them into these fortresses. And it doesn't work. These things mostly go bankrupt.
Well, in a moment, I want to talk with you more about why you think that suburban-style shopping malls in downtown cities are a bad idea. Well, we left off with your criticism of suburban-style shopping malls built in urban centers. What are some of your objections to these city shopping malls?
Well, the main thing is they deny the street. And if you go out and take a look at a suburban shopping mall, you'll see they're mostly blank walls. Well, that's not so bad out there. That's rather functional. There are no passersby to attract with display windows, because there are no passersby. You made the decision to go into that mall when you drove your car there. You get in the cities, and pardon me, it's an entirely different thing. And you do need impulse. You do need those windows. But most of all, you need the look of retailing, the look of the busyness of the city, people buying things, people selling things out, you know, available from the street. You don't get this in a suburban shopping mall that is transplanted to downtown. And to a rather surprising degree, these things, particularly the very large ones, Renaissance Center in Detroit is an example, the very large ones have either gone bankrupt or are near it.
Mm-hmm. You talk about how disorienting it is inside some of these really large malls, where you look at one of these You Are Here maps,
yes,
and you see a dot, and the only thing you can tell is that I'm here in front of the pizza chain. Well, you still feel really disoriented.
Yeah, where's here?
Located
where's here?
That. Yeah. Yeah. And then another problem, I guess, is that if the shopping mall takes a lot of the street traffic and moves it inside, do the streets become less safe by virtue of having less traffic?
Yes, they do. This is one of the most distressing things of all. There's a terrible price to be paid for turning your back on the street. And what happens is, so I'm going to oversimplify a little bit, but you get a sequence that runs like this. People say, let's put in a couple of overhead walkways to get people off the street. And so they'll be safe, and also so they'll be warm in these terrible winters and so forth. So they put in a walkway and then another walkway, and then they put in their sort of shopping along the second level walkway. And so pretty soon, they have a very vested interest in getting people up to that second level, or in any event, within this complex rather than out on the street. So the next step is the blank wall. And it's no coincidence that the cities which have done the most to get people off the street, you know, put them up in overhead walkways or down in subterranean walkways, those particular cities are the ones who have now started lining their downtowns with blank walls. St. Paul, Minnesota, a wonderful city. Now, you walk downtown, you can't see it in anything except blank walls.
But do you think the streets are less secure when a lot of the people have moved inside?
Yes, certainly. Mm-hmm. Actually, let me say one thing about Center City security. This is a very live subject whenever we're talking about downtown. The curious thing is, and I've kept pretty good records on this thing, the downtowns of most American cities are the safest places during the time that people use them.
Mm-hmm.
There are very little. I can think, I know pretty well what's happened on most of the plazas here, and there have been two incidents in about the last 16 years, really serious incidents. There was one killing at Bryant Park, and there's a couple of other things I know about. But by and large, they're quite safe places. I'm not talking about dead of night, because you'd be foolish to go there.
Will you also object to how inside megastructures, which are the mixed-use places that are part hotel, part shopping, part office, part restaurant, how those and the shopping malls control behavior inside? Impromptu street performers aren't allowed in. People with handbills and pamphlets aren't allowed
in. I've just come from Cincinnati, a wonderful city. It has one of the great public squares in Fountain Square. They also have a new atrium, an indoor area, part of the Westin Hotel there. And part of the deal was that they were going to, in exchange for getting to build, hire their hotel, they were going to make a big public place. Well, they didn't do it. And this is characteristic of what is happening in many cities. You see, if you're a nice middle-class person, you're well-dressed, that's all right. They don't give you a hard time. But what they really want are shoppers, and they want middle-class people, and they shoo out other people. And I think that should be against the law, for one thing. But I think it's also very short-sighted. You can't have a public place and get all the benefits of having a public place, and they say, well, we're only going to have those members of the public that we approve of. One of the great geniuses of a city is as a place where people come together, and that includes, unhappily, but necessarily, some people we don't particularly like.
What recommendations would you make now to urban designers who are trying to revive their downtowns?
I'm going to repeat an answer that I gave to a similar question a little while ago. They should go and spend some time on the street, most particularly a street corner, to see how the place really works. And I think they will discover some things that can make their planning much better. And I go back to the time when I first started doing my work on the city. This was the time when everybody said the great problem of the city is this crushing density. There are too many people. Let's get the people off the street. And an awful lot of very terrible things were done to cities. Whole sections were razed, demolition. That's one thing. I think my lord for good old Westchester, Pennsylvania, which did not have its downtown destroyed, but many, many communities did. And part of this came from nobody paying attention to how people really worked. The public housing projects, for example, it was quite obvious the way people, what they preferred and what they didn't, that they liked two-story, low-rise public housing far better than they did those gross towers, one right after the other. And yet, year after year went by without the lessons being applied. I think the core of the problem is a failure of the part of our planning and design mechanisms and outfits to check back on the ground how people are actually using the city.
If you recommend against urban shopping malls, what alternatives would you recommend?
Well, I think the city as it is a pretty good alternative.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just pick off. As far as, say, shopping streets, the best shopping streets are not in malls. They're Madison Avenue here in New York. They're, good old Chestnut Street. Well, it's not what it used to be in Philadelphia, but it's coming. Newbury Street in Boston. Now, that's very cheesy. That's very sort of high style. But the city is a great place for retailing. It's really it's one of the hearts of the vitality of a city. And that's why having these great big interior fortresses is a denial of the great function of the city. And I think that one way to say, what is the function of the city? Yes, it's come on some very hard times in Philadelphia, and particularly one thinks of North Philadelphia, and I remember all the great manufacturing plants that used to be there. Cities have been losing manufacturing. This is gone in many places. They're even losing computers and high-tech stuff. That's going out to the suburbs. That stuff is already out there. But as the city has been losing out on a lot of its previous functions for which it's no longer really able to discharge them, as it's been doing that, it has been reasserting its most ancient function, and that is as a place where people come together face to face. And that's the true genius of the city.
One last question. You've spent so much time not only observing city life through hidden cameras, but also hanging out on street corners, watching people interact. Were you ever arrested as a loiterer?
I never was arrested as a loiterer. Funny thing, though, you know, for somebody standing taking notes, it just drives a lot of other people crazy. And the minute I go to a place, I won't be there more than 5 or 10 minutes. And all I'm very, I try to be as unobtrusive as possible, taking notes, or my researchers. Almost invariably, somebody comes in, hey, buddy, what are you doing? Do you mind telling me what you're doing? He's a regular of that particular block. They want to know what you're up to. The dope dealers I really worry about, because often, you know, you aim a camera somewhere, and chances are, whether you know it or not, you're getting a dope transaction. I've had some dope dealers come after me. I'm scared to death of that. But by and large, most people are reasonably frank. They want to know what you're up to. They want to know what you're up to. The idea of somebody standing in one place just observing is a very freakish behavior from their point of view. But I've enjoyed it. And one last thought, it's wonderful for one's ego. Because after a while, when you get to know how people are going to act, that probably there's 100% conversation, they'll move into the center of the traffic stream, or that there's a couple that are saying goodbye and they've just had a failed goodbye, you can be pretty sure there are going to be two more goodbyes before they actually part. And once you notice how they react, you begin to get the feeling that somehow, because you can predict these things, you get the feeling that somehow you're causing them. You know, it's a wonderful thing. They're not, of course. The people exist quite in it, but I get the feeling that, my people. And when I see them do these things, it makes me feel good.
You live in the city yourself?
Yes, I do, up on 94th Street.
Okay. I want to thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you.